This is our final session of the seminar on Vedic philosophy, substance and shadow. So taking up where we left off yesterday, I want to now bring up some problems with what we heard, what was discussed yesterday. So it was said yesterday that the actual praman or proof of everything in Krishna consciousness, of everything in our process of knowledge, is shabda, spiritual sound. And then it was said that the comprehension of the shabda unfolds in five stages. So the first stage is pratyaksha, which as you know means perception. Just that we're perceiving, we're hearing the sound, we're seeing the devotees, but we really don't understand anything. So everyone starts on that platform, pratyaksha. So now, someone who is very doubtful may say, all right, so you say there are stages of realization of the sound above pratyaksha, and finally there is this aprakrita stage or divya pratyaksha, divine perception, where you actually see Lord Krishna in the form of His holy name, you see the form of the Lord in the spiritual sound vibration, you see the Leela, just like when, actually Prabhupada, he said that this Jai Radha Madhava is a perfect song. That's why he wanted it chanted before every Bhagavatam lecture, because he said everything is there. Every line of that song is describing a feature of Goloka Vrindavan. So the whole song together is the complete Goloka Vrindavan. Jai Radha Madhava Punja Vihari Upi Janabhava. So at the aprakrita or divya pratyaksha stage, then by hearing Jai Radha Madhav, then the whole of Vrindavan is revealed directly before the spiritual senses of the devotee. So someone may say, yes, all right, that is your explanation. But now we are on the mundane pratyaksha platform. And you are asking us to simply accept this shabda. You're saying we shouldn't challenge it, we should accept it submissively. In other words, you are telling us to take a leap of faith. So then really, how are you any different from all the other religions or ideologies? Because they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying, believe in us. So how is it any different? I mean, what you say, shabda is the proof, and yet at this pratyaksha platform, it's not proof. Because we just hear this sound, we don't know what it means, it doesn't unlock spiritual perception in us, because we're, as you were saying, our desire is impure and all that, so so it's the same old thing. You know, we go to the church and we hear them say, believe in Jesus. And you're saying, believe in the chanting of Hare Krishna. And others are saying, believe in this or that politician. So what's the difference? So, then I give an example of a... Here, I'll just read. Vaya Pratyaksha, the personality of Godhead, is not directly seen through words that describe Him, but the proof of His potency is the effect of those words. A blazing fireplace, the heat of the fire, and the servant tending the fire are equally responsible for keeping a room warm on a winter's night. Sleeping in this room, I cannot see throughout the course of the night how the fire is burning nicely, nor whether the servant tends it. But the proof of all this is the effect. The room does not grow cold at any time. Similarly, as Srila Prabhupada said, the potency of spiritual sound, the potency of the person speaking that sound, and Krishna's own potency can be understood through spiritual warmth. When one is warmed by the potency of spiritual sound, he becomes transcendentally joyful. Sense gratification and mental speculation, which chill the heart and place us in distress, are dispelled as soon as the heart is flooded by the joy of Krishna consciousness. So just like, of course, India is generally very warm, but if one goes to the northern countries, then wintertime is very cold. Sometimes there's 1 meter of snow on the ground, so it's icy cold. So you may stay in some house as a guest, very, very cold outside, but there is a fireplace. Now a fireplace, as you know, you have to keep replenishing the fire with wood or coal to keep it burning, otherwise it will burn out and then the room will become cold, you'll freeze. But you're told, don't worry, there's a servant and he will attend to that very quietly, he won't disturb you, you just sleep. So you're sleeping, that means you're not watching, you're not able to see the fire, you're not able to see the fire, nor can you see the servant, how he's coming with additional fuel and putting it on the fire, tending the fire. You can't see that. But how do you know? How can you know, even though you're sleeping, that the fire is burning nicely? It's because you're warm. It's actually, in this example, it's actually because you're able to sleep so nicely that you know. Because it's very nice and comfortable, and therefore you can sleep. If the fire would go out, then 12 o'clock at night, you'd be waking up, trembling and shivering, your teeth chattering, oh, it's so cold. But if that doesn't happen, then you can have confidence. Yes, the fire is burning, the servant is there. You don't see, but you have confidence because of experience. It's an indirect experience. So similarly, I remember in the very beginning days of ISKCON, when we go on Harinam, we used to hand out these cards. On the one side, there would be the Hare Krishna mantra, and on the other side, it would say, chant these holy names and your life will become sublime. So, we all came to Krishna consciousness, because I remember myself, I actually started chanting Hare Krishna even before I knew there was a Hare Krishna movement. Before I even knew there was ISKCON, it was from this Allen Ginsberg who Prabhupada told in the 60s, wherever you give a poetry reading, because he used to travel around and read poetry, you should always start the poetry reading by chanting Hare Krishna. So before I knew anything about Srila Prabhupada or ISKCON, I got a record of Allen Ginsberg chanting Hare Krishna. And then a little later, I happened to see him recite his poetry, and he started by chanting Hare Krishna. So I was already chanting Hare Krishna, even before knowing that there was an ISKCON. It was later on that I used to hear people talk about a Hare Krishna movement. And of course, then I was very interested. Oh, you mean there's a movement? But I was already chanting Hare Krishna, not very regular at all, but just sometimes. But I used to like it. There was some kind of effect there. It used to make my mind peaceful. It used to lift me up out of the bodily conception. So whenever I wanted to, you know, kind of become spiritual for a little while, I used to chant Hare Krishna. So I had no idea of... You see, I was a total, at that time, total impersonalist. I had no understanding that the Hare Krishna mantra was the name of a personal God, Krishna. I had absolutely no idea of that. You know, I thought it was some kind of, you know, magical formulation of mystic syllables or something. But still, the effect was there. Still, I could feel when I chant this mantra, these words, Hare Krishna and Rama, then this does transform the consciousness. So this is the example. You don't need to see directly Krishna in his holy name. You can chant now at this present level of pratyaksha understanding and still experience, as Prabhupada called it so nicely, spiritual warmth. Now, but there are people, we call them asuras, demons, who hate the sound of Krishna's holy name. They become aggressive. They hate devotees. They become disgusted by the philosophy that we are not this body, that this material world is actually illusion, and that we should focus our human life on going back home, back to Godhead. They find this absolutely disgusting. So we could say, all right, a reasonable person, a pious person, a person who's not so excessively sinful, if he chants Hare Krishna, then he'll feel that spiritual warmth. But a real demon materialist would say, yeah, that's because, you know, he was grown up in a kind of religious family and he still is hypnotized by all this theistic nonsense. And therefore, when he meets you guys, you know, you can hypnotize him. But you can't hypnotize me. Because I'm a down-to-earth realist. I know what is what. And when I hear you guys chant Hare Krishna, it makes me angry. So what is that for spiritual warmth? Ha! The nonsense talk. Doesn't make me feel good at all. I become very angry that you're cheating everyone. I want to throw rocks at you. And that is the actual realistic response. That is a truly sane person. He'll respond in this way. He'll want to drive you out because you're cheaters, you're brainwashers, you're cultists. You just want to steal everybody's children and turn them into zombies and make money, sit on a big hill of money and chant your Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Counting money at the same time. That's all you're good for. So, then how do we respond to that? So, I phrase the question, apart from your so-called proof of joy, which neither appeals nor applies to me, can you give a sensible reason why you think this so-called transcendental knowledge can be transmitted through the language of my present experience? This is a person who is saying, the only thing language can do is transmit what we experience now. You see? You talk, like I give some examples. My experience is that all forms are material, perishable, and limited. That's what form means. Form means something that doesn't last forever. Like this body, it's going to die, it's going to wear away. And yet you're talking about eternal forms. Well, that's just nonsense. That's just nonsense. You're just playing with words. It doesn't mean anything. It has no reality. This is again this correspondence theory. See, words, they only have meaning when they correspond to real things that we perceive. So you talk about Krishna. Where is he? He's not here. So it's just nonsense. You talk about eternal form. What's that? There's no such thing. So what you say doesn't make any sense. So how can you explain that the so-called transcendental knowledge can be transmitted through the language of our present experience? So then our reply is, but before challenging the meaningfulness of spiritual sound, a person on the pratyaksha level should explain how words transmit knowledge within his experience. In other words, the question is, how do words transmit any knowledge? How do words transmit even material knowledge? For instance, I give the example of the word airplane. Now, how many know what the word airplane means? Raise your hand. Let me ask it another. Does anyone here not know what an airplane is. So you don't know? So everybody knows that there's an invention, a mechanical invention which has wings and some kind of motor and flies in the sky. And that's called an airplane. Everybody knows that. Now let me ask you another question. How many are seeing an airplane right now? Nobody. So then here's the mystery. And how is it that this word, airplane, or you can say it in Bengali, Viman, or in German, Flugzeug, or whatever, you know, how does this word, how is it understandable to us? We're not seeing an airplane. Nobody's pointing to one of these machines flying right here and saying, airplane, and then we go, oh yes, I see, I understand the word. There's no such thing. Yet we know what the word airplane means. Now that's pretty occult. That's pretty mysterious. You see? So, I have never seen, there's so many airplanes in the world, you know, that exist now, that have existed in the past, that will exist in the future. There are books and stories about magical airplanes, some kind of futuristic science fiction airplane. Yet I can immediately understand in each of these cases what is meant. I immediately understand it. And yet the thing is not before me. It's like the Japanese, they attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941 with dive bombers. Now how many of us were there? How many of you saw, were in Honolulu in December 7, 1941? None of you. But everyone's heard this. Everyone's heard it and everyone knows what it means. The Japanese airplanes, they dive bombed Pearl Harbor, and that's how the United States entered the Second World War. Everybody knows that. And yet nobody's seen it. So this is actually very mysterious. Even if someone's telling a lie, you understand. Even if someone says, there's an airplane in the sky overhead right now, but there is none. It's a lie. It means it's absolutely not true. But you still know what he means. You still know what airplane means in that case. Now someone may say, well, all right, he goes from Pratyaksha to Anuman. He says, no, there's a concept of an airplane. We've all learned. A concept. And therefore when we hear that word, this concept comes to mind. It's a universal concept. And all examples of airplane are included into it. Now that just makes it much more complicated, that's all. You know, first you had the word airplane, and then the thing, the meaning. But now you've added the concept. But how is it that the word now should invoke a concept in my mind? What is a concept? And I'll ask you another question. How many of you, if concept means some idea that's stored away somewhere in your brain, and you have to refer to that, is that our experience with words? You know, when someone says airplane, are you consulting very quickly in your mind a dictionary? Airplane. Oh yeah, I know what it is. No, the word itself conveys the meaning. If you've learned that word, then afterwards, airplane, immediately, without, you don't have to think, what does this mean? Immediately the meaning is there. So this is very mysterious, and actually the modern philosophy admits, this is an admission of modern science and philosophy. I have two quotes, one by a big philosopher named Quine, a big American philosopher, and then one by a man named Charles Vest, who's the president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, which is probably the most famous, one of the most famous scientific institutions in the world. And both of them are saying that we don't know how words convey meaning. We have no idea. We have no idea how words convey meaning at all. And in fact, this Quine, he says, what is meaning? And he said, the best thing is not to talk about it. And then he says, evidently, meaning means the same thing as idea. There is actually an original sense to language And that original sense is transcendental. In Vedanta Sutra, it is stated, try to find the exact quote here, Charachara vyapashayas tu syatad vyapadeshu bhaktas tadbhava bhavitvat, which means, as will be learned from hearing the Vedic Shabda, every word is a name of the Lord, because He resides in all moving and non-moving things. So actually every word in every language is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls Gunanama. It's a name of a quality of Krishna. And that name or that word, like tree, it has the potency to convey a meaning to us. As soon as we hear the word tree, we know immediately what a tree is. How is that possible? It's because of the presence of the Lord Himself within that name, within that word. But Gunanama, it's indirect. There's Shuddhanama, there's Abhasanama, and then there's Gunanama. So the Gunanama is ordinary language. Just like, again, the word tree. So Srila Prabhupada actually said, a devotee, he sees a tree just like a non-devotee. He sees the same thing, but he sees it differently. He sees the connection of the tree to Krishna. And he also sees the connection of the word tree to Krishna. In that all words are originally, they originate on the Brahman platform. All words are originally spiritual. Why? He resides in all moving and non-moving things. So actually every word in every language is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls Gunanama. It's a name of a quality of Krishna. And that name or that word, like tree, it has the potency to convey a meaning to us. As soon as we hear the word tree, we know immediately what a tree is. How is that possible? It's because of the presence of the Lord Himself within that name, within that word. But Gunanama, it's indirect. There's Shuddhanama, there's Abhasanama, and then there's Gunanama. So the Gunanama is ordinary language. Just like, again, the word tree. So Srila Prabhupada actually said, a devotee, he sees a tree just like a non-devotee. He sees the same thing, but he sees it differently. He sees the connection of the tree to Krishna. And he also sees the connection of the word tree to Krishna. In that all words are originally, they originate on the Brahman platform. All words are originally spiritual. Why? He appears externally as a Mahanta. Mahanta means a great devotee. And he speaks the Shiksha, the same instruction of Lord Krishna, external to us, which we can receive through these ears. That is the same spiritual sound vibration. And so by this we can become delivered from our illusion, from the trap of karma and jnana. And now someone was asking a few days ago about how we can actually realize, what is the process of actually realizing these Vedic truths that we hear from the spiritual master. So it's a fivefold process. Moving from ignorance to prema, pure love of Godhead. And these five levels, five stages of Vedic knowledge were explained by Prabhupada in a number of different lectures, and they're indicated also in a few places in his books. So in my book I kind of brought them all together. So the first stage is pratyaksha. Now we know this means perception. So just like you come to the Hare Krishna temple as a new guest, so you're on the level of pratyaksha. You don't even know what to think. It's bewildering. So the Anuman is not working. You can just see. You can just see the devotees. I can clearly remember my first visit to a temple. That was exactly my state. I was just looking, not understanding anything, just looking through my senses and wondering, what does this mean? So, but what are we looking at? We're looking at Krishna's devotees, the sadhus. And a sadhu, a devotee, Prabhupada says, all devotees, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has requested us all to be guru. Amara gaya guru tanre desh. You become guru. This is his instruction to everyone. There are different kinds of guru, of course. There are some who formally accept disciples, and others may not. But everyone must be guru in the sense of tanre desh. You must save the people around you. And guru means acharya, one who teaches by example. Achar means behavior. So one comes to Krishna consciousness on the level of pratyaksha, but what is it that we're seeing, perceiving? We're perceiving the behavior of the devotees. When we mix with devotees, that is what we see. We see their achar, their behavior. We see they chant Hare Krishna. We see they rise early in the morning. We see they take only Krishna prasada. We see they follow the regulative principles. We see they live together in a spiritual community. So, and we can hear them. Actually, hearing is more important even than seeing. So this is pratyaksha, seeing and hearing, tasting, smelling the incense. In this way, our senses become engaged in the service of the Lord by the grace of the sadhus. And so from this pratyaksha, then one ascends to the next stage, which is called paroksha, which means knowledge through another's senses. This is what happens when we begin to accept the prabhus, the devotees, as our authorities. Prabhupada gave a nice example in explaining this paroksha. He said, just like you have a friend who lives thousands and thousands of miles to the west, where you live. So you call him up long distance on the telephone. Now where you are, it is night time. The sun has gone down in the west. And you ask him, how are things over there where you are? And he says, oh, it's a bright sunny day. So you don't see that. For your eyes it is dark. But you're hearing through the telephone, he's describing to you, yes, it's a bright sunny day, I'm looking out the window, there's not a cloud in the sky, it's blue sky, and the trees are in bloom, and the children are playing, and the birds are singing, and so on and so on. So by his description, then we can see that sunny day where he is. So that's paroksha, seeing through the eyes of others. So just like new bhaktin, you were attending the classes, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita classes, hearing from the devotees, and thus beginning to see the spiritual world, beginning to see Krishna through their descriptions. Beginning to understand this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So there's a stage, you must all remember it well, where we're just, you know, new devotees, they're just quoting. That's all they have to say is what they heard. They heard a tape from Srila Prabhupada, or so-and-so Maharaj said this, or such-and-such Prabhu said that. Their discourse is entirely made up of quotations that they piece together from other devotees. So this is paroksha. Now they themselves, much of this that they're repeating is still beyond their understanding, but they repeat it anyway. But this is good, because this leads to the next stage, which is called aparoksha, or direct knowledge, or Prabhupada called it realizing. as we follow the achara of devotees and as we hear from them, then we become purified and we start to realize the philosophy. We start to understand the philosophy ourselves directly. So this is actually the stage of Anuman in Krishna consciousness. Or Prabhupada also uses the word vichar. Here, I will give a quote from Srila Prabhupada. Vichar means you just try to understand the gift of Lord Chaitanya by logic. Vichar. Don't follow blindly. Following blindly something, that is not good. That will not stay. But one should take everything with logic. In other words, vichar means deep consideration. One should come to the stage where we can consider deeply ourselves this philosophy. Understand what is going on within us and around us through the eyes of Shastra. This is aparoksha. And thus, at this point, one can begin to speak with realization. Correspondingly, at this time, devotees, then they're empowered actually to give nice classes in Krishna consciousness, because that's actually what other devotees like to hear, is the realization. So one on this aparoksha platform, he's starting to have realizations. Then beyond that is adhoksaja, revealed knowledge. There are five tattvas. We've been speaking of tattva, the truth. So you know, Srila Prabhupada explains in the Bhagavad Gita introduction, there are five subject matters or tattvas in our Vaishnava philosophy. The first is the Ishwara tattva, then there's the Jiva tattva, then the Prakriti tattva, material nature, then the Kala tattva, time, and then karma, activity. This is another tattva. So each of these, if they're called tattva, this means they have their true state or their true form. And so at the Abhokshaja stage, which is actually the stage of knowledge revealed in the heart by the Paramatma, by the Supersoul. Then you see at the Aparoksha, the previous stage, Anuman, one is, one is explaining these tattvas by some kind of intuition or insight. But at the Adhoksija stage, it is actually revealed. The Lord in the heart, Lord Adhoksija, that is the name of Krishna. He reveals himself. And when he reveals himself, then the true nature of the jiva is also revealed. The jiva is revealed. The prakriti, the actual form of material nature, is revealed. Kala, the time factor, is revealed, eternal time. And karma, the true meaning of activity, that is also all revealed. It's no more that we're approximating it by mental speculation, you see. Speculating, but guided by the Shastra. Philosophical speculation. But one is actually in touch with the truth directly. So that is the fourth stage, adhoksaja. Then aprakrita is the fifth stage, that is spiritual knowledge. Aprakrita is the ultimate stage in which the Lord's divine lila in the spiritual world. Aprakrita means actually beyond prakriti. At the adhoksaja stage, one understands prakriti, this material nature, as the energy of Krishna. But aprakrita means then one's realization even surpasses the limit of this material world, enters the spiritual world, and one actually perceives. Prabhupada said the ultimate goal of Krishna consciousness is to see how God enjoys. Such nice, simple language, but it is the deepest truth of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. To see how God is enjoying. And Srila Ramanujacharya has called this stage Dibya Pratyaksha. So actually you can also think of it this way, five stages beginning with pratyaksha and ending with divya pratyaksha. Divya means divine perception. When all, at this stage, all of the senses, the eyes, the ears, the smell, the taste, the touch, all of these senses are fully spiritualized and fully connected with Krishna. Some of you may have, I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read, sometimes in the VIHE they give classes in the Madhurya Kadambani by Srila Bishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So he is describing that stage when the senses become enlivened in complete Krishna consciousness, and each sense, he describes how each sense becomes mad after Krishna. And thus Rupa Goswami, in that nice prayer, he's praying, when I chant Hare Krishna, I pray that I may have millions and millions of tongues, because I find the holy name of the Lord so sweet. So I want to have millions of tongues by which to chant Hare Krishna, and millions of ears to hear the holy name. So this is the stage of divine perception. So in other words, just as we are now perceiving, of course we're in Mayapur, so we're, the wonderful thing is that we're already perceiving the spiritual world right now. But we may not be perceiving it so spiritually, perhaps. This is the spiritual world, but perhaps we're not perceiving it so spiritually. But anyway, just as we can now, so without any effort at all, perceive the material world, so the Dibya Pratyaksha, or a Prakriti stage, one is perceiving the spiritual world, Lord Krishna's pastimes. What time is it now? Huh? Oh, it's already past time. Okay, we'll continue tomorrow with a bit more about Shabda. I'm going to raise some problems, some doubts about transmission of knowledge through sound, and answer those doubts. So any questions? Yes? His question is that I had stated that we are not seeing Krishna because of lust, kama in the heart, and then I said there are five stages of knowledge by which one comes to the stage of being able to see Krishna. So what is the relationship between the two? Please explain how kama is transformed in terms of these five stages. Well, very briefly, because that could receive a very complicated or very detailed answer. But very briefly, at the first stage of pratyaksha, the senses are of course dulled. Our senses are habituated. Actually, this is a good way to understand material conditioning. It means we're just habituated to material consciousness. So the senses are dulled, habituated to lusty perceptions and lusty feelings. But as we engage our senses in the service of the Lord, in association with devotees, then the senses are gradually purified. First of all, we're given by the grace of Sadhu Sangha the strength to restrain the senses in the association of devotees. You can stop the senses from engaging in lusty activities. And then gradually, as one is becoming purified of that lust, then one is ascending through the five stages. I mean, you know, to go through each of the five stages and explain how the level of lust goes down, that's, I don't have time to do that now. But generally, that's the answer. The first thing is that you have to stop. You see, that's actually the first stage. That we must stop these sinful activities. Adau Shraddha, first there must be some faith, Tata Sadhu Sangha in the association of devotees. And then, Atta Bhajana Kriya. Then we engage in purified activities, bhajana kriya, which means anartana vritti. It automatically means, as Prabhupada explained, all sinful activities have stopped. So that's actually the real beginning of the real beginning of the end of lust. Yes?
You mentioned spiritual mind and pure mind.
Yes.
The question is there only one mind or there are two minds? Because one sense you can say that the pure mind is some other category or something.
The question is, because it was mentioned spiritual mind and material mind, so does that mean there are two minds? And I suppose you mean, you're asking if right now if we have two minds. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
And sometimes the one mind is working and other times the other mind is working. We have only one consciousness. So as I said, mind means consciousness. But the consciousness can either be under the material influence or under the spiritual influence. Now, this question about maybe we have two minds is arising because, as Prabhupada said, the jiva, he's tatastha, he's in between. He's in between the material potency and the spiritual potency. The bahiranga shakti and antaranga shakti, internal and external potency. He's between. Prabhupada once explaining, he said if the jiva leans a little this way, then he's in darkness. If he leans a little this way, he's in light. And sometimes we're going back and forth. And then we may think I have two minds. But no, you have only one mind in the sense of only one consciousness. But the question is where you put that consciousness. And because the jiva is marginal, it's very easy for him. It's, even, you know, just becoming a little inattentive, suddenly he's in maya. So it's very easy to switch back and forth. You become a little inattentive, you slip into maya, and then you go, Hare Krishna! And you jump into a kirtan and take a lot of prasadam. Then you feel enlivened again, hear a nice class, you feel completely Krishna conscious. You feel like a pure devotee! And then because you're puffed up, again you slip. Even without checking it back into maya. So in this way we go back and forth.
It depends on the content of the mind.
Yes, or in the object of the mind, what the mind is focused on. Behind you. Yes. He's asking about the 11th canto, four stages of sound. So I'm also going to make this explanation very simple. There's Chaturvyuha, Vasudev, Sankarsana Pradumna Aniruddha. And Vasudev is on the para platform. That means transcendental. So there's Paravak, the transcendental sound. And then you have Vaikarana Vak, Madhyama Vak. I've forgotten the terms. But anyway, then there's three lower levels. So these refer to the three modes of nature, or three stages of material sound. Three stages of creation, actually. Three stages of creation. So, from Vasudev, who is on the para, transcendental platform, then are expanding Sankarsana, Pradumna, Aniruddha for the process of creation. So with each one, there is a associated sound vibration which is causing an appropriate manifestation of material creation. So that's a simple explanation. Now you're asking about chakras and all this mystical stuff. anyway, we don't concern ourselves with that in Bhakti Yoga. That's not required. Yes? Yes, that was the point I'm going to talk about tonight. Okay, so let's... Oh, last question. Uh-huh. Not quite. Yes. Ah. Yes, well, that tendency is innate in the human being. In other words, as every form of life has its particular special qualification. Prabhupada even said every form of life has a particular mystic power. Like he once said, the trees, they have the power to eat through their feet, the roots. That's something we can't do. Or the birds can fly. That's something we can't do. So what sets apart the human being is that very tendency for self-realization. Srila Prabhupada said the actual purpose, the innate purpose of the human form of life is liberation. And therefore dharma, the real meaning of dharma, dharmasya hi apavargasya, is to become free of vargas. Vargas means all the distresses of material life. And you see, even in this, you're speaking of this corrupt culture, but that's there nonetheless. Even in modern technological civilization, what is everyone working for? Ultimately, they're working for the removal of all distress in science or medicine, technology. They're looking to live forever, to prolong life. They're looking for knowledge, to remove ignorance. And they're looking for happiness, bliss, ananda, satchit ananda. But the problem is that they're misguided. The Prabhupada said that is the fault of misleaders. Persons who are, again, we have to use the blunt language, demons. The demons have, there's that statement in Bhagavatam, Rakshashim Kalim Ashvita Jayante Brahmani Yonishu, that in the age of Kali, Rakshashas take the form of the Brahmins, which means the intellectual class. Whether in India, the caste Brahmins, or in the West, the so-called priests, the learned men, philosophers, scientists, who occupy the same role as Brahmanas. They're Rakshashas, they're demons. And so the pleasure of a demon, a Rakshasha, is to mislead people, lead people deeper and deeper into darkness. So that's what they do. But the tendency, the innate human tendency, to work for deliverance from all material distresses, to find a solution to all problems of life, that is there, even now. So therefore the Krishna consciousness movement, Prabhupada said, this is the greatest benediction because it is the actual process by which the human being can accomplish his true aim, what every human being really wants. This is the actual process.
Mm-hmm.
Why he would give up that? Yes, well, this is what you pointed at is the X factor. In a mathematical equations, they have the factor X, which means it's unpredictable. So this is kripa, this is mercy. That Chaitanya Charitamrita verse, Brahmanda Brahmate Konse Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasari Bhai Bhakti Lata Beach. So when the jiva becomes Bhagyavan, fortunate, then Guru Krishna Prasari Bhai. And by the grace of Guru, he gets Krishna. By the grace of Krishna, he gets Guru. So this is the X factor. I think I better stop now. Hare Krishna, thank you very much.
Good!